Welcome to the Everyday Innovator Podcast for product managers, developers, and innovators. Your host is Chad McAllister, who gives you innovation training your customers will love you for. Get ready to take your career to the next level, for the doctor is in.
Hi, this is Chad, your host and founder of Product Innovation Educators, online training to provide product managers the knowledge and skills to be successful. I look for exceptional guests to share their experience and knowledge, making good use of the time the everyday innovators give to this podcast each week. And I know you're going to love our guest today. He has been a mechanical engineer, product manager, global product manager, and as of June, the leader of the innovation group responsible for the transformational innovation strategy at a really big company that makes really big machinery, Caterpillar. In his bio, he describes himself as leader, listener, coach, mentor, team builder, and communicator. And when I talked with people who work with him, they only had glowing praise to give. I expect you're going to find the discussion really valuable. To get the notes, go to theeverydayinnovator.com/046. Now on to the interview. Hi, Ken. Thanks for talking innovation with me today.
Thanks for inviting me.
Glad you're here. So let's just kind of dive in with the big background here about you getting to Caterpillar. When did that start? What was going on?
Gosh, when I came to Caterpillar, I like to tell people I was 11 years old because I've been here for 33 years now. I don't think I can get away with that story anymore. But in all seriousness, my mom tells a story about me coming home from Mrs. Summers' second grade class and telling her that I was going to go be an engineer and work for Caterpillar, which might not sound all that unusual from someone from Central Illinois, but none of my family worked for Caterpillar, and I was the first one to go to school. So this has been something that that I've wanted to do and loved doing for a long, long time.
Do you recall what was going on that in second grade you knew you wanted to be an engineer?
Across the street lived my best friend, whose grandfather was one of the bigger contractors in Illinois, and he owned all Cat equipment. And often said, and he didn't, except for one exception, he had Case backhoe loaders. And I remember him saying that if Cat made a backhoe loader, I'd have a Cat, I'd have all Cat.
It's kind of coincidental. When I was 7 years old, which I guess would have been second grade too, my neighbor across the street lived in Littleton, Colorado, suburb of Denver, was a electronics engineer. And he's the one that taught me to solder and helped me build my first metal detector. And I ended up in electrical engineering after that. So I guess second grade is a important point in a young man's life about how what they're going to end up doing.
Yeah, we never told our moms how much equipment we were running at a very early age with his grandfather and uncles and the guys on the crew. We were running equipment when we were really, really young and never got away from it.
Yep. So you must have then gone to engineering school, and did you start at Caterpillar right out of school?
I started Caterpillar as a co-op, actually, after my sophomore year at Bradley University here in Peoria. And back in the day when you could go to school a semester and go work as an engineer for a semester, and got my earned my bachelor's degree that way. But during the downturn in this business in the early 80s, finished my bachelor's degree when I was outside of Caterpillar, worked for an aerospace company for a short time, and then like the moth to the flame, came back to work at Caterpillar, where I really wanted to be.
Yep, made true on that original dream. So you've been in lots of different roles there, engineer, project manager, product manager, program manager, and other management and leadership roles. And as I did talk with a few people in the organization that have worked with you or know you, and they really did talk about your leadership really kind of standing out as a key characteristic. What principles guide your leadership philosophy?
Well, we could go on and on with this one. I manage my team with a principle we call the kitchen table, and it was born a long, long time ago at my parents' own kitchen table, where we were expected to share at the table every day, and there were no topics that were off limits. In fact, that was the only time that you could get away with talking about certain things with my dad. So those were the times that we brought up the tough subjects. So that's when he wanted to hear about it. And it's a principle from my family and a good friend of mine, Philippe Petit, who I worked with when I was an expat in Belgium. We were talking about the principles that we wanted our teams to live by, and his family did a very similar thing. He grew up in a town called La Roche, outside a town called La Roche, Belgium, and the principles of family were very, very simple, very, very similar, where his father wanted to encourage conversation, as mine did. In fact, he made sure that everyone in the room said something, spoke up. That was a principle. Listening was very, very important to him. In fact, he would call you out if you didn't say anything. And I think that this idea of listening, I'm sure that's where it came from. It started very, very early. And for me also, I'm, if you read my profile, you'll see I'm low vision. So most of what I get is verbal. Mm-hmm. So I'm just naturally, I think, predisposed to hearing what people get, because about 90% of what I learn is through listening. I don't have another choice. So I think that's the other element of it. My teams are rankless, including me. You can say anything when we actually declare that it's kitchen table time. So if there's a really tough conversation to be had, my team will say, okay, Ken, kitchen table. And that's a sign that you can talk about absolutely anything that you want to talk about. And it's just a way, we have encouraged people to be brave, with all the teams that I've run, and it seems to work really, really well.
So you're encouraging that kitchen table to be time that the tough issues are addressed. And in some organizations, this culture unfortunately gets built where only the good news is brought to leaders, and we never actually uncover the issues that we need leaders to help us address and bring resources in and solve the problems. It sounds like your kitchen table is trying to fix that.
It is trying to fix that. And Chad, I think what you have to do is practice before the really tough issues come up. So you need to put, what we have done, and I think it's almost serendipitous in a lot of ways. I don't think I'm that bright. I think we just found that this worked, that if you're practicing open communication and talking about practicing, in our case, we call it the kitchen table. If you're practicing this before the issues are really, really tough, that it's like any other, maybe it's like a sports analogy. You know, if you're practicing your golf swing in the right way, which is something I can't do, but if you're practicing it in the right way, when the time comes and you have to hit the good shot, if you're really well prepared and have practiced, you can do it. Mm-hmm. If you wait until a tough issue comes up and you have to take that to your leader and you've never done it before, chances are that you're not going to be successful, or the chances of success are going to be pretty limited. So you need to, as a leader, set up an opportunity to practice these tough conversations along the way.
Yeah, and that practice is kind of like building muscle, right? It gets into the system, and you start with the little problems, and it's easier to talk about the big problems then.
Absolutely. Absolutely right.
The other thing I thought was really interesting that you said was listening, and part of that comes out of your struggle with being with low vision, but having to become a good listener, there's different levels of that, right? And I suspect empathy plays a big part in your listening, that you're not just listening for the words, but for the meaning and message behind that. Am I reading too much into that, or is that accurate?
No, I think you make me sound better than I am, but with that question, but I've always thought of listening as being a very active process where you're asking questions that clarify, you're asking questions that test in some ways. The kitchen table, by the way, doesn't mean that you can just bring any idea to the table and throw it out there. You need to be prepared to defend your idea as well. So, mm-hmm. And some of the best leaders that I've ever worked for were asking questions that in some ways I thought they knew the answer to. I might be wrong, but I think they were trying to ask questions that were helping me or the other leaders in the room think about our business in ways that maybe we hadn't thought about them before based on their experience. They're using questions to teach. As opposed to coming in and barking orders, the best leaders tend to ask questions based on insights they have gained through their own experience that help new leaders learn on their own. And I think that's really, really important that you allow your team to learn along the way. But one of your roles as a leader is to take the team places it might not go without you. Mm-hmm. And the only way to do that is to, again, you're trying to find a palatable way of sharing your experiences. And one of the most palatable ways is by asking questions of them based on your own experience.
And for the everyday innovators listening, you might be wondering why I'm asking these questions, diving in about leadership and listening skills. And we'll get to the innovation role here in just a second. But it's really about, this is a recurring theme that comes up when I talk to people in organizations about the importance of actually listening, raising issues, being empathetic, and bringing together people from diverse backgrounds to be innovative. So let me dive into that role with you now. So you are in a new role at the organization, just started a few months ago. I believe your current title is the Caterpillar Director of Innovation. How did this role come about? And also, I understand it's associated with the Analytics and Innovation Division, right? And so maybe you can tell us how the role came about and what the analytics aspect is of that.
Caterpillar has been an innovator in the businesses that we've chosen to be in for 90 years. You don't survive 90 years without being a very innovative company. Mm-hmm. That said, we've become a much larger company than we were when I joined it when I was 11 years old, as I said earlier.
That's right.
And to the point where, you know, we've divided into business units that are much more manageable pieces of, that are just manageable pieces of the business. And so what we found is that we have, with an organization this size, we have pockets of great success around innovation. We have some great products, some great services, but what we were seeing from a business performance standpoint, and this is all public record, if you look at our performance, our top line performance since about 2009, our top line is essentially flat with one anomalous year. So the recognition was that we needed to be more innovative to grow our top line, to continue growing our top line. And Doug Overhelman, the chairman, wanted to take some specific actions to help this organization be more innovative, and decided that the way he was going to do that was take some of his people that he thought had been very successful at a division level innovating and try to more broadly create a culture of innovation and apply it across the whole enterprise. And that's really why he created this role and this division. And then I think the other aspect of it is our effort around analytics. And the thinking there is that many of the ideas that we are generating are coming from analytics, are coming from the 2 million connected assets we have around the world, for example, the telematics and data that we have coming back to us that are teaching us how our customers are using our machines. Really, we're learning far more about what our customers are doing with our machines, and it's generating ideas around which we can innovate. So the idea was, the thought process was that we needed to keep the analytics team very close to the innovation team, and I think that's why they put the two together in this division.
So the analytics is really that customer connection, learning from how the equipment's being used and getting the insights from the customers to help drive new product innovation.
I'd say it's certainly one of the customer connections. But you know, the source of data sources, there are so many sources of mm-hmm. data. It's as you know, it's a challenge to even list them. But we have certainly gathered some tremendous customer insights over the years from the data we're gathering from the way our machines are used, for as an example, that has changed the way frankly, everything from design through how we deliver our product.
And tell us how that data is actually collected. I suspect that on the new machines, a lot of this is just automatic in some sense, right? That there's data collection capabilities. I don't know what's involved, though, in that data collection.
You know, I think for most people most everyone is familiar with the OnStar system at General Motors, at least what it does. These are really connected, like their vehicles and many other manufacturers on highway vehicles. Our vehicles are connected, and we receive data virtually continuously about the machines that we have running in the field, and can know about everything from how many hours of operation they are accumulating to the fault codes they are experiencing. And then there's another level of data collection that we are capable of doing that when we develop a new machine and introduce it to the field, or as we're developing a new machine, we can get a tremendous amount of information back by instrumenting the machines and receiving data, telemetry data back from those machines. We've learned a tremendous amount in our product development process as we add more and more sources of telemetry data to these development programs.
Okay, good. Yeah, so it's a built-in capability in the systems. And these are really big machines. And just as a quick aside, I had the pleasure of being touring the visitor center there in Peoria, Illinois. And the first thing you come to is the theater, right, where you kind of hear the background of the Caterpillar story. And you get to sit in the bed of at that time, it was the largest mining truck. I don't know if it still is or not. But this truck, you could fit 100 people in the back of this truck. It's an impressive size machine. And when we were out for our year-long RV trip that kind of started this podcast, we were up in Wyoming, and we went to a mining operation to see just how this works. And we saw these machines in effect. And just the scale of these mining trucks was most impressive.
Well, for me, I'm like a kid in a candy store when I go in there. It is a fun place to visit.
My kids loved it, right? Because you get to sit inside the cabin of these machines and pretend like you're controlling it. And it's lots of great fun.
I think that's what probably what drew me here first was the size of these things. And then, but what I think most people don't understand very well is how sophisticated they are under that huge skin.
Cannot appreciate, even with my engineering background, all the engineering problems that have been solved through years dealing with the huge amount of forces that take place in this kind of a scale of scale of machinery.
The huge forces, and I think the other cool engineering problem is the unpredictability of the forces.
Mm-hmm.
It's really if you add the size of the forces that we're dealing, the magnitude of the forces that we're dealing with, and the unpredictability of the environments that we're in, that leads to some really challenging and interesting engineering problems to solve, which is, I think, Chad, what's kept me here for 33 years.
There's always new problems, you know, and with that engineering background, we tend to like solving problems.
That's exactly right. Exactly right.
So you talked about the group being created for top line growth, and you know, typically companies, when they're interested in top line growth, we either sell more of what we have, which usually means we are looking at new markets, or we're doing new product development. And a lot of companies have adopted a new product development strategy to enhance the top line growth, and you know, come out with new products on a regular schedule to have products for existing markets and penetrating new markets too. Is this group looking at both enhancing existing products and doing new product development? What does that look like?
I'm going to say yes and no. We want to get far beyond the product and itself in this division, as well as helping the divisions who are responsible for developing new product. We want to do that, but we really want to get outside of the machine. We tend to be historically focused on how do we make a better machine, what's the better design look like, and then how do we manufacture that machine more effectively.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this organization, while we're going to do some things that are going to support those traditional activities, we're going to be trying to get more outside of the machine, if you will, than where we've historically been. So I tend to think of this organization as we're really trying to create new viable businesses for Caterpillar. Both new, we might be finding new markets, new customers, new products, but I really think the key word here is that we're trying to find new businesses for Caterpillar. And that's all, what our ultimate objective is. And then I think my role has three components. If I think about innovation from an aspirational point of view, and we can use various terms, but I think of it in terms of core, adjacent, and transformational. Core innovation to us is doing that which we already do, but doing it better. Adjacent innovation then is finding ways that finding businesses, finding opportunities that are either logical extensions of the businesses we have today or span across the businesses that we have today. And then the truly transformational things are, you know, if 10 years from now you and I are hanging out on a beach somewhere talking about Caterpillar's business and you say, you know, Ken, I never thought that Caterpillar would be in that business. Mm-hmm. That to me would be the result of a transformational innovation. So my team's role across those three, for the whole enterprise, we're thinking about the community, culture, processes, and tools that can help innovators innovate. So in so much as we're going to provide that community for all of the innovators at Caterpillar in the core, that's how our team's active in the core. But it's really about culture, processes, and tools in the core.
Right. And innovation often gets down to those three things, right? Culture,
it really, really does. And so we have a very important role for the whole organization around those three pieces. Mm-hmm. Then in the adjacent space, you know, we really want to be, you know, the connectors in the adjacent space. We'll run projects, we'll do that work if we have to. But in the adjacent space, which again is extensions of current businesses or businesses that opportunities that span current businesses, we really want to be the connector accelerator in that arena as opposed to doing it ourselves. And then in the transformational space, we really are the drivers. We're the Google X of Caterpillar, if you will. We are looking at opportunities that Caterpillar is not in, may have not considered being in, and we're going to drive monetization of ideas in those transformational spaces. Those are the three elements of what we do.
That's an excellently clear framework, Ken. I appreciate you sharing that. And I just want to reiterate it for the everyday innovators that are listening, because I think this is such an important framework to get our hands around. And often organizations are struggling with, you know, what is our real innovation strategy? And they need a framework, right? And you laid it out as the core work, the adjacent and the transformation, the core really enabling the culture, the processes and the tools, the adjacent opportunities where you're being a connector and accelerating existing work that's going on and getting that to market more quickly. And then transformation, you know, the Google X of the organization, right? Really looking at those things that could be the new businesses for the company in the future. Did I summarize okay?
Yeah, that's perfect. Summarize that very, very well.
Okay. And it reminds me a little bit, lately there's been a lot of comments on the Three Horizons approach, which is kind of a similar sort of idea that, you know, what are we doing now that's core to our business, is bringing in cash? What's a little bit further out, maybe in the next, depending on the organization, you know, 2 or 3 years, that is related? And then what are those really new things that are, you know, the 3 to 5 years out? And I think Jeffrey Moore was the guy that actually did that first. He's not always credited with it, but I think he's the one that did the Three Horizons framework. I've always kind of just struggled with the Three Horizons, and I actually really resonate with the core, adjacent, transformation categories that they just make a lot of sense to me. So I appreciate you sharing those.
No, and no pun intended, there are gray areas between the three, right? I mean, it's not crystal clear. It's not a very sharp delineation between what's between always between what's core and adjacent. And I don't want to get into the debate too much. Mm-hmm. And I don't want us debating it too much internally either, but we've got some sense for which domain we're working in all the time with those three categories. And we're trying to think of it in terms of portfolio management, if you will. I really do want to have a sense for how much of our innovation portfolio work is in the core, how much mm-hmm. is in the adjacent space, and how much is in transformational. And I don't have a specific formula for that, but my belief is, based on some of the benchmarking we've been doing externally, is that we probably need to be in the 70-20-10 percentage kind of split, where 70% of the work, I mean, you really do need to focus a lot of your time and attention on doing the things that you already do better. Mm-hmm. And I think it's perfectly fine that you spend a lot of your time on the core, continuous product and process improvement, in our case, new product introductions. Those are core. That's core. And don't want our business to get away from that, and want to make it easier for them to innovate in the core. But then again, I think, you know, you've really got to be kind of pushing your way away from the core if you really want to grow top line. I think if you really want to have, you know, much more significant growth in top line, I think you want to find, you know, 20% of the portfolio is in adjacent, and probably 10% of it is, you know, with the wild stuff out on the transformational edge.
Mm-hmm. And I also happen to notice that your innovation strategy here of core, adjacent, transformation is the acronym CAT. I don't know if that was that planned or not.
I'd love to say it was. It was not. It was not. In fact, we noticed it after, I've had a lot of, again, you know, leaders are often credited with being far more clever than they are when things go well. So let's just write it off as, yes, that was a brilliant idea. It actually wasn't. It just happened that way, which I've laughed at a lot since we did it.
You know, there might be something that you have actually soaked up some of the CAT DNA.
That was very much subliminal and really not intended at all, which I think is just hilarious.
It fits well.
I'm glad you picked that up.
So you've had the benefit of being there 33 years, and not everyone that's involved in a role leading innovation in an organization has the benefit of being with the company for so long. But I have noticed, probably more times than not with people I've talked to, that is indeed the case, that it's the people that are leading innovation efforts have a long history with the company. And one thing that gives them is typically they're well-networked. They know the organization well. They know a lot of the past history. And in that adjacent role, you talked about connecting. And how much do you see your group being responsible for connecting the organization in terms of capabilities in, you know, one bucket or silo with what might be going on in another area to really do something new or to help each other out?
I think in an organization this size, it is a huge responsibility for us. We have 110,000 people. One of the challenges in a community of 110,000 people is just, first of all, understanding what is the current activity. I'll just take one that we've been open about that we're working on. What's the current activity around 3D printing within a company the size of Caterpillar? And there's a lot going on. Just establishing a community around 3D printing to make practitioners around this huge organization aware of what one another is doing is an important responsibility. You want to make sure that it's not governance, it's not control that I'm after, it's awareness that we're after, to make sure that we have a vision for what 3D printing is for Caterpillar in the future. It's a very dynamic vision because those technologies are changing so fast. But are we running the right experiments around delivering that vision? And are we changing our vision based upon the outcomes of the experiments that we're running? Who's running the experiments? Make sure that they're complementary experiments. And, you know, and make sure that these practitioners are connected, sharing best practices, I think is really key to what we do. One of the very key things that we do, especially in the adjacencies.
Mm-hmm. Can you share any specifics that you're doing to help structure that flow of information and how people just, I realize a lot of this is kind of, you know, in some sense, there's a virtual water cooler in large organizations like this. This just happens. But is there anything you're doing to structure to try to make that interaction happen and the sharing happen more frequently?
You know, we've put together a couple of communities. We have each of our divisions has an innovation champion, and who's really kind of an innovation conduit, if you will, between us and these big divisions. And we have established a community of these champions for the purposes of sharing. And in fact, I get to sit down with them Monday morning, and it's one of the most fun meetings that you could ever. I don't like meetings, but it is a fun one to go to because it's so vibrant. It vibrates with ideas. Innovation is one of these things that if you know it's not a corporate initiative. It's a groundswell. There's a pull for innovation in this organization like no other, for lack of a better word, initiative that I have ever experienced in my 30 plus years here. It's not coming from the top. It's coming from our people and our role has become one of supporting them. So we're putting together these communities around each of these technologies. So we have a 3D printing community, which is, in my mind, it's kind of like a wiki in some ways with real people involved. And so there's a lot of effort around making sure that we're sharing information. We are about to roll out what we actually call our innovation community in early November. Which is the best practice tools and processes available just to help people through the process of innovation. You know, what are the best ideation tools? What process is working in our earth moving division? What process is working well in building construction products? There's a great interactive tool that's coming out that will help people who want to ask questions get in and figure out whether if they really want to get deeply into the processes that are working at Caterpillar, they can. If they want to get into, you know, how do you do a crowdsourcing type of question, they can get into that at that kind of a lower level as well. So there's a in an organization this big, you know, you've got to find some, I'll say, codified way of sharing information like that, processes, tools, best practices.
Right.
And it can't be top down. The other part of the design that's really, really important is that the community of innovators themselves are designing what this thing looks like and the content that it has. One of the things we have to be careful of in a big company, you have to have processes around new product development and purchasing, legal, et cetera, that reflect the risks associated with being a global company. And those processes work really, really well for introducing a new track type tractor or hydraulic excavator. But you also have to have a set of processes available that allow experimentation on a quantity of one. So the supplier agreements that you might have in place or the non-disclosure agreements that you might need to have in place for a massive new product introduction project that's running worldwide are very different than what you have to have for experimentation in an innovation project.
Mm-hmm.
So those things were actually, and what's interesting that the innovators are identifying these, we call them brick walls today, these brick walls that need to get knocked down so that they can experiment. And we're knocking them down. You know, you have to knock them down one at a time. You know, we need a non-disclosure agreement for X. that we didn't need for a major NPI program. Okay, let's get that in place and then make that available for everyone to use. Let's get a supplier agreement in place for a quantity of one mm-hmm. for a new supplier. Okay, let's get that agreement set up. Here's the boilerplate. Let's make that available to everybody. And these things we're learning how to knock down as we experiment with moving faster and faster in the innovation space.
So let me highlight a few key things there for people listening that are thinking about, well, how can I really help my organization, embrace innovation? It has the culture there is such that this has been bubbling up from the bottom for a while. And as you said, it can't be top down. But indeed, you are providing top-down support to enable it. Like you said, you're trying to tear down some of those walls, and that requires senior-level management to make that happen. And obviously, this group is a testament to the commitment of the organization to make this happen. And you've done some structuring that is really important that this, sometimes organizations will say, okay, we're going to start doing an innovation, in our company with an innovation group, and they'll be responsible for all innovation, right? And it doesn't disseminate to the other groups. But you've structured it that you have connections to an innovation champion in each of the divisions. So there's already that communication taking place, creating communities of practice, it sounds like, for people sharing, and then providing that top-level support to actually see changes take place. And so that you're not just, unfortunately, as some organizations do, when they talk about we need a new innovation initiative, you're not just talking about what you want to have happen. You are breaking down those barriers that get in the way to make it happen. Fair summary?
I think that's a very fair summary. I would say just a couple of other points, if I could. Mm-hmm. I would say that we're being very careful not to take over the role of innovator for the company, nor are we allowing any of the business divisions to abdicate their responsibility for being innovators to us, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. The whole idea is that that the business divisions are in place, they're responsible for their own divisions, and they are very innovative people. We're trying our level best to ensure that we are supporting those activities and as opposed to governing those activities. And in fact, one of the things that we did was we've actually drawn our organization structure as a tree where I'm at the bottom of it. Mm-hmm. And the leaves of the tree are the members of our organization. So, and my role is to support them, and we wanted to do this in a visible way that the idea is really one of leadership. You mentioned we've put in place leadership has to support this activity, and we wanted a graphical way of showing that. So we're basically the leaders in this organization are supporting the innovators. We have flipped the org chart upside down, the classic org chart upside down.
Mm-hmm. Makes a very good sense to me. And it directly supports the strategy you laid out of core adjacent transformation of, being this base to help try to enable more of an innovation culture, providing processes that work, sharing tools, and then at the adjacent level, connecting across the organization, providing, again, resources to help accelerate projects. And at the transformation level, really driving those new ideas and finding, I would expect, partners in the divisions to run with the ideas and be an enabler for the organization and not the classic, leader who is really controlling the direction, but instead just being a catalyst for what's already there.
That's what we're trying to do. It's a work in progress. That's what we're trying to do. Well, it may always be a work in progress, but that's what we're trying to do.
So for organizations that are trying to go down a similar path, right, thinking about that they recognizing that they also need to grow top-level growth, that they need new products into the system, and want to do something to help with innovation. A lot of times this gets started with a conversation, how do we change our culture to be more innovative? Maybe we need to create an innovation group, and what does that mean? What advice would you share with an organization that is at that place that's thinking about, okay, maybe we need to do an innovation group?
Get started. Our tendency would be to plan and spend a long time thinking out how we want to do this, my recommendation is to get started and experiment your way to find what really works in the in your organization. Mm-hmm. And if you can look at your top line numbers. If they're flat, you're probably focusing a lot of your time on continuous improvement or all of your time on continuous improvement. You're probably going to find, if you look at yourself hard, that 100% of the work you're doing is in core. And you're not going to save your way to top line growth. So I would, my advice is to take action and simply start. And some of the best places to start are obviously in culture. And I think what I've experienced is that the most innovative companies are the ones that establish mutual trust between leaders and their teams. And what happens and I really think the focus needs to be on the culture first. What happens is, in the most innovative companies, people with an idea know they're seated at the kitchen table and they can bring that idea to their leader because they know their leader will support them. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, on the other side of the coin, their leaders are giving them freedom to work on the things that they want to work on, because leaders trust that they've hired the very best people and they trust them to work on the things that are most important for the organization. So my advice is, get started, and get started on culture first.
Very sound advice. And throughout this conversation, you've talked about what the work you're doing and this group as an enabler, right? And I love that kitchen table analogy, that creating trust around bringing problems and bringing ideas, and then finding support and resolutions and resources for moving forward. Great metaphor. And I'll probably end up thinking about my dinner conversation tonight with my kids a little bit differently.
Wow, I feel like I've done something today.
I'm sure more than that. So as listeners know, as we get towards the end of the interview, I always like to ask my guests about an innovation quote and why you chose that one, how it's important to you. What innovation quote did you bring for us today?
You know, I'm going to read it because I want to be exact about it. I always talk about it in generally, so this will be the only thing that I've not done extemporaneously with you today. It's anything that won't sell, I don't want to invent. Its sale is proof of utility, and utility is success. And that's Edison. And I really think the reason that's important is because I think I wish I could pick his brain, because I think he's really talking about the difference between invention and innovation. Because really what I'm pushed with hard with my team is, you know, our customer's going to pay you for your idea. We're always looking from an innovation point of view. We want to grow it or fix it, and we're always starting with a customer's problem or opportunity. How can I help the customer solve a problem, or how can I help the customer enjoy an opportunity that presents itself? Mm-hmm. And so ultimately, if you're truly an innovator, your customers are paying you for it. That's the ultimate measure, and I love the Edison quote. If they're not gonna buy it, I don't want to invent it. It's just a perfect attitude that you have to have. We're not at this simply because we've got a cool idea. What we really are after are ideas that make our customers better, and so much so that they're willing to pay us and make us better in the process.
It does draw that distinction between invention and innovation. And I know a lot of quotes, and actually I was not familiar with this one. I appreciate you sharing it, and I will be using it in the future too. And it is all about, you know, as innovators, as product developers, we care about adding value to our customer. And if we're doing a good job with that, then they want to respond by paying us for that value, compensating us for that value. Thanks so much for sharing that quote. That's just great. Anything that won't sell, I don't want to invent.
Right.
Ken, I so much do appreciate you sharing that strategy laid out, the core adjacent transformation. I think that's just golden. And so much else we talked about, the kitchen table and how you're enabling and being the catalyst there for innovation in the organization. And Ken, in terms of just listeners finding out more about Caterpillar and what you're doing there, any resources that you have to share?
Well, if readers would like to join us at cat.com or caterpillar.com to find out in general what Caterpillar is doing, they're more than welcome. And we're also about to launch a new site on caterpillar.com. It's caterpillar.com/innovation. If you'd like more about what we're doing and our experimentation in the world of innovation and how we're moving forward.
And listeners, I also have those links in the show notes to make it easy for you to find those. Ken, once again, really appreciate your time. So interested in seeing how this group makes an impact at Caterpillar, and look forward to watching that, and hopefully we can talk again.
I really enjoyed being with you, Chad. Thank you so much for the invitation.
Thank you for listening. It makes my day when a new listener contacts me and tells me they discovered the podcast from a colleague that told them about it. Thank you so much for sharing this with your friends. Go to theeverydayinnovator.com/046 to find the show notes and details of the discussion. Keep innovating.
Thank you for listening to Product Innovation Training your customers will love you for. To learn more, please check out the blog at theeverydayinnovator.com. Keep innovating.